all yoga is apolitical. So sometimes people will tell me, oh, yoga and politics don't match. That is the same level of extreme statement as saying all politics and yoga go together. So I don't know that there's any one. Some people might say the best way you can help the world is by refining yourself. I'm going to meditate for world peace. The trouble that I find is that if somebody truly believes that something they see out in the world is wrong, maybe it did and I'm unaware of it, it's totally possible, but most meaningful and lasting changes that we've experienced have come from people taking direct action. Women didn't get the right to vote through meditation. They got the right to vote through marching in the streets and demanding it.
Herzlich willkommen bei Personality Talks, deinem Podcast für ein freies und inspiriertes Leben voller Persönlichkeit. Ich bin Simone Lopez Sanchez, Chefredakteurin und Co-Gründerin des Online-Magazins Personality Mag, Yoga-Lehrerin, Texterin und psychodynamischer Coach. Zusammen mit meiner Freundin Sabine Köhnlein habe ich Personality Mag gegründet, ein Online-Magazin rund um Persönlichkeitsentwicklung, Yoga, Coaching, Self-Care und Wellbeing. Hier im Podcast treffe ich spannende Persönlichkeiten und ExpertInnen zum Gespräch. Menschen, die mich interessieren und die mir mehr über ihren Beruf und ihre Passion verraten und die mich mitnehmen in ihr Leben und ihre Denkweise. Warum? Weil wir fest daran glauben, dass man aus den Geschichten anderer Menschen viel lernen kann. Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von Personality Talks. Ja, wir sind wieder da und ja, den Podcast gibt es natürlich noch. Wir haben ein bisschen länger Pause gemacht, aber wir sind freudig zurück in 2024 und freuen uns auf tolle neue Gäste. Und der erste Gast in diesem Jahr ist der Advanced Certified Jiva Mukti Yoga Teacher Jules Verbrey. Es ist ein sehr langes, nachdenkliches und bewegendes Gespräch geworden. Und wir sprechen über Jules Kindheit in New York City, über das Aufwachsen an der Lower East Side, über seine ersten Kontakte mit Yoga, das erste Mal Yoga-Praxis, die erste Reise nach Indien mit seinem Onkel David Life, über sein Verhältnis zu Yoga, zur Yoga-Praxis, zum Yoga-Unterrichten und wie sich das über die Jahre auch immer wieder verändert. Wir sprechen über besondere Momente, über fast magische Momente in seinem Leben, wo sich immer etwas verändert und gedreht hat und seine Haltung dazu. Wir sprechen darüber, wie sich die Yoga-Praxis und auch das Yoga-Unterrichten verändert, wenn wir Eltern werden, über Disziplin, darüber, was die tägliche Praxis oder die Praxis generell eigentlich braucht. Und natürlich sprechen wir über die Sutren, die wichtigen Texte. Und Jules hat sofort die passende Stelle parat, als ich ihn danach gefragt habe, wie wir eigentlich als Eltern es schaffen, immer wieder diese Hindernisse zu überwinden. Also wir sprechen über Detachment, die 9 Obstacles und wir sprechen darüber, ob Yoga politisch sein sollte. Jede Antwort ist eine Einladung, darüber nachzudenken und gleichzeitig eine Einladung zur Inspiration. Und mich hat das Gespräch danach noch sehr beschäftigt. Vor allem der Hinweis darauf, wie wichtig Community für uns ist. Also das Zusammenkommen, like-minded people finden und in wie vielen Bereichen eigentlich das Spirituelle als Basis unten drunter liegt. Ich wünsche euch ganz viel Inspiration und Freude beim Zuhören mit Jules Verbrey.
How are you today?
How am I today?
Not meant as a superficial German question.
Whenever somebody asks me that and they ask me that question earnestly, I always remember this Ram Dass quote. Well, I don't know if it's really a quote, but something he says in a talk, and he says, you know, when people ask me, Ram Dass, are you happy? And I stop and I look inside. I see, yeah, I'm happy. And if somebody were to ask me, Ram Dass, are you sad? And I stop and I look and I say, yeah, I'm also sad. So usually my answer is, if somebody's asking me how I'm feeling and I want to give an honest answer, I will say mixed. Mm-hmm. Because if I look for a specific emotion inside, I'm sure I could find it. Right now, I wouldn't say I'm feeling super strong one way or the other, but I'm good. I'm happy to be here with SLS for the Personality Mag podcast interview. So, yeah, that's how I'm feeling. And you?
Honest answer, really, how you would say, a lot of emotions going on, a lot of things inside, but looking forward to talk to you.
All right, wonderful.
Would you say it's easy for you to really deeply connect inside and to have an access to your emotions?
I would say depends on the emotion, probably. Mm-hmm. There are some emotions that are very easy for me to connect with. Although I would say most, it's a weird thing, right? Like, if I say I am connecting with my emotions, it assumes that there are two separate things happening. My emotions and something that I call me. But the thing that I think of is of me as me is made up of my emotions. Mm-hmm. So you're asking me a little bit of a trick question. I would say that, or I will say that, it's easier for me to express certain emotions that I'm feeling, and it's harder for me to express or communicate other emotions that I am experiencing at any given moment.
What did the yoga contribute to that? How is it still contributing to that, or helping in connecting with the own feelings, emotions?
I feel bad because so far almost every answer that I've given you to your questions is essentially mixed. The question first is, or the way that I understood your last question, is the emotions that I'm experiencing, to connect with them, to give them space, to recognize them when they're there, communicate them when necessary. What role has yoga played in those different capacities? Communication, experience, expanding. And again, for some emotions, it's been very helpful. And for other emotions, not so helpful. And so I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
For those who are somewhat new to a yoga practice, or like me, have been practicing for a long time, but maybe didn't understand so well, or thought I understood really well, and so therefore it kind of kept me where I was. Yoga can come across as searching out positive experiences. So, and a positive experience like a peaceful experience. We often begin a class with Om Shanti, 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 peace, peace, peace. And there's this idea that you cultivate peace in the practice. And then through the different asanas, you might experience frustration or anger, or I can do this or I can't do that. But the idea is, okay, keep coming back to peace, keep coming back to peace. However, that can be nice, but it sometimes translates as constantly looking for peace, which is another way of saying moving out of the feeling that you're experiencing in that moment. Mm-hmm. So, and because in an asana class, which is what most people practice, myself included, when one has 45 minutes, 60 minutes, 75 minutes, 90 minutes, 2 hours, it's a little bit challenging to say, okay, I'm experiencing frustration in this moment. Let me sit with the frustration and experience the frustration. What is the frustration a symptom of? And how can I learn from this, or as you said, connect to this emotion? Because you got 5 breaths, maybe. You have 5 breaths here. Then it's on to the next. And what's being reinforced is the connection to breath, this idea of equanimity of mind, even in the fluctuation of the movement. And I think this is a wonderful tool to have, but it doesn't really allow for a deep connection to the experience that you're having. So, what it works on is a sense of awareness that is based in concentration, that requires, to a certain extent, the exclusion of everything else. So I'm sitting down, I'm moving, I'm doing a vinyasa practice, and I'm concentrating on my breath. When other things come, I might recognize them, but I don't indulge them, I don't sit with them, I focus, it's concentrative. It's not necessarily an open awareness state of concentration where, oh, okay, there's tightness there. Ah, it's in my leg. I recognize that the tightness in my leg is causing me to engage my back in a way that is causing some stiffness in my neck. But the stiffness in my neck isn't really coming from my neck. It's coming from avoiding the tightness in my leg. So the same thing happens with emotive qualities. Anger, frustration. I find that my frustration isn't really... That's one emotion, but that's just a surface layer. Underneath that is maybe the sense that I should be doing better. I should be further along in my asana practice than I am. But that emotion or feeling or thought was so quick, and the frustration is so long, but the process is so quick, the asana is so quick, that I don't get to really follow it all the way. So an asana practice that is kind of a classical vinyasa practice that is relatively fast-paced and short in nature is, for me, sometimes an obstacle to connecting meaningfully with my emotions as they arise. And the yoga practices that have helped me to connect more meaningfully are meditative practices. You could also call them a yoga practice, but not necessarily mantra-based meditation, because mantra-based meditation is also concentrative practice, right? You have your mala and your whatever it is, Om Mani Padme Om, Om Mani Padme Om, Lam, 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 Lam. And something comes and you just back to the mantra, back to the mantra. So it excludes a lot. Or let's say you go to a kirtan. You ever seen a bunch of depressed people at a kirtan? I mean, maybe they were depressed, but they don't look depressed, right? They're like clapping and chanting, and they're trying to cultivate a very specific emotion. And they're trying to connect deeply to that emotion of joy, of ecstasy, of bhakti, of devotion. So that also, it's like in a certain superficial understanding of different yoga practices, it can be very challenging to connect deeply to any emotional state, except for the ones you're searching for, shanti, devotion, the equanimity of mind with the breath. So as my yoga practice has grown and evolved, I've learned to try to cultivate, as a point of practice, other emotional qualities. What would it look like to be chanting at my harmonium in front of my altar and cultivate a sense of anger? But have it elevated. My teacher Shamdas gave this wonderful teaching, like, could you transfer your anger to a divine sense of purpose? Like, oh, you know, I've been devoted to Krishna my whole life, and I heard he appeared in this other yoga studio 3 blocks down. That's terrible. But you're dedicating your anger so that it is not a base emotion, as sometimes it's called, but an emotion that represents, if we use anger, energy rising. Or let's say jealousy could be a sign of great capacity. So to recognize these emotions, to delve deeply in them, how has yoga helped me? Certain practices and certain teachers have pointed to a sense of nuance in understanding, and sometimes other practices have become obstacles for me when I didn't understand them well.
Mm-hmm. So if I visited a class of yours and I would come afterwards and say, I feel anger, but I didn't have the time to, let's say, sit with it, would you mm-hmm. recommend me afterwards to like go into a meditation, sit with that anger, discover that feeling and find out about it?
I think I'd have to know you a little bit before I gave such direct especially for meditation, you know, if like somebody's super angry and I don't know what their base level is, and then I'm like, go and sit with your anger, and then they end up punching their partner or something like that. So, you know, like I don't know. But I think if we were to have a group meditation, and you were to tell me, in this meditation, so, you know, sometimes I'll teach a class, we have a meditation, 15 minutes. Then we talk about it. What was the meditation like? What was your experience? Mm-hmm. And then we do another 15-minute meditation. And we were all together in a room. I would tell you to use that sense of anger to keep you in the present moment. Mm-hmm. So to say to yourself, ah, there is anger there. I am experiencing anger. What is the physical... How do I know that that is anger? Is there a physical sense? Like, how do I know that's not jealousy or greed or frustration? Like, why do I call it anger? Okay, so does it have any physical characteristics? Do I feel it in my fingers, in my face, in my chest? Mm-hmm. Do I feel a sense of adrenaline rush? Do I want to get up and move? Is there an anxiousness in the body? If you can direct your mind to each of those physical manifestations of this emotion that you call anger, then you are in the present moment each time that's happening. Mm-hmm. And that will transfer to a time when it's not necessarily anger, but something else. Maybe it's just a physical sensation that's similar to anger. It's the wanting to move, wanting to get up, wanting to fidget. Mm-hmm. And then you notice, ah, there's perhaps a sense of wanting to do, wanting to control. Ah, where do I feel that? And so to explore the feeling as a process of meditation, mm-hmm. that would be my suggestion. But I would also prefer to do it with you as opposed, unless you've been with me for a long time, that would be my preference.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but now I want to know a little bit more about you, because it is an honor to have you in this podcast, because I think you are one of the persons in this modern yoga world where we can get a glimpse of how it all started, how it is to grow up with yoga, how yoga can change. And I would like to know a little bit of your first... your first experiences with the practice, because you had first experience, if I did my research good, when you had been a young boy at the age of 13.
Even earlier.
Even earlier. Bad research. Yeah. So take us a little bit with you.
Sure. So a mini history is what you're saying?
Mini biography. To understand, because it's really when I first discovered you as a teacher and I read about you, I thought, oh, that is crazy. That's interesting. And then I got caught up by your beautiful wife. But like, it is really, I thought, okay, there's a lot to know and there's a lot to, I got a little bit, what is ehrfürchtig? How you say this? What is the English
like inquisitive?
Word? I don't know, like, when I did a class with you in Düsseldorf once, and when I entered the room, I thought like, oh, I had these, oh, you know, when we have like I don't know, when you know there's the teacher sitting and there's a lot of things coming up and ehrfürchtig, I don't know the English word. But let's travel
I get the sense.
Yeah,
let's, okay. I think the way that I usually tell this story, and maybe it's important for me also to remember that it is a story and that because it's been told many times, it's like any story, it's changed a little bit, it's evolved, and maybe I'm misremembering some things, and maybe my mom would tell it different, or Sharon and David will tell it different, but Sharon Gannon and David Life are the co-founders of Jiva Mukti Yoga. David is my mom's brother, and David moved to New York City in the late 70s or early 80s, and my mom, who was 10 years younger, followed shortly after. This eventually, David transitioned from what he was doing in his world to practicing yoga, which was still, 80, 81, 82 was still somewhat obscure in most circles. So he started practicing, and then they started teaching. And from what I understand, he was very curious about how do young people, Western particularly, how do they react to yoga? You know, within yoga, there's so much about masculine and feminine, about left side and right side, Ida and Pingala. I know these days, binary existence or binary world of masculine and feminine is a little bit frowned upon as being a base reality, but this was the idea and kind of the blending of the two. So he was interested in teaching young people yoga. And so my mom sacrificed her firstborn child to the yoga gods and laid me on the altar as a sacrificial little bekasana. And myself and another young girl from the neighborhood, I grew up in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, started practicing with David every once in a while, like once a week, twice a week, something like this, when I was 6 years old. And so we would practice at his home, at his apartment. And, I think, I don't really remember the classes so much, but there were some moments that really stuck with me that I think informed my yoga practice. And one of them is, so I don't know how much you know about New York City, but the apartments there, particularly in the 80s, like if you, in the Lower East Side, tiny, super small. They make a Parisian apartment look grandiose and very large. So he had a studio apartment where the bathtub was in the kitchen. Right? So there was just a room where the toilet was, and then the kitchen also had the bathtub, and then the bedroom wasn't a bedroom, wasn't a separate room. It was just like a little space off to the side. And he had hooked up Iyengar rope walls in his bedroom. And he had a mattress on the floor that rolled up. And I just remembered, in hindsight, thinking, the place that he lived and the place that he did his practice, it wasn't the same place. There wasn't a separate, it wasn't like, okay, I'm going to go here and do my practice and then I'm going to go home and then I have my home life. It was the whole thing that he was doing was his yoga life. And he used to say that can practice the asanas, the meditation, those aren't necessarily the hard things. Doing them every day is the hard part, mm-hmm. the consistency. And so these things have stayed with me for a long time from those first kind of contacts with yoga. But I was also growing up, as I said, in a somewhat rough neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So the projects, I don't know what you would call them in Germany, but in the UK they call them like council flats. It's essentially where people live, where the city or the state pays mm-hmm. their rent and pays for them to live. And they have these huge structures called the projects in New York City, mm-hmm. all throughout the United States. And, you know, thousands and thousands of people living in there, and they can be very rough. And so I didn't live in them, but I lived right across the street from them. And the building that I grew up in, so on our floor, I mean, like the floor that we lived on, Erste Etage, we had, we were the only apartment that people were living in. All the other apartments were burned out. So no people were living in them. Mm-hmm. And the doors were closed with a big chain and a lock. And then upstairs maybe was one or two families. And then upstairs maybe one. So three or four apartments were empty on every floor. It's basically like a semi-abandoned building. Mm-hmm. And I grew up outside a lot and running around. So I had kind of these two upbringings. Mm-hmm. On one side was a yoga practice with an uncle and an aunt who were artists and yoga practitioners and made yoga their life and were starting a business, starting a methodology. And then the other side was a little bit chaos. Mm-hmm. And I hung out and I preferred a little bit more the chaos. Mm-hmm. Particularly, at a certain point, David became a sannyasin. He was a renunciate. Shaved his head, wore orange, so refused to use money or tried not to use electricity mm-hmm. or fire. And like all of these things became very challenging for him eventually, so he let it go. But, you know, growing up, hanging out with friends in an empty lot or a little playground, and your uncle comes on a bike dressed in orange, mm-hmm. it's a challenge.
Yeah.
So I created a little bit of distance, although I was still practicing some yoga. Mm-hmm. And I had a moment where some friends, like I was 13, and some friends that I was hanging out with, one of them shot and killed himself. And then another one ended up serving a long time in jail, 5 years in jail. Another friend got stabbed. And so some of them were older than me. Some of them were very close in age. And I just felt like maybe I'll lean a little bit more into yoga. And so I asked Sharon and David if I could go with them to India.
I love it.
Yeah. They were going to India every year for 2-3 months at a time. Mm-hmm. And they were practicing with Patabi Joyce, Ashtanga Yoga in Mysore. And they were spending time in the Bihar Hills with one of their teachers, Swami Nirmalananda. And then they would also sometimes spend a month or two in the north with this person, Shandas, this teacher, Shandas. And so at 13 years old, I got permission to leave school for 3 months. And I went to India. And I studied for 2 months in Mysore with Patabi Joyce. Ashtanga yoga every morning. And then spent a month traveling. Spent some time in Vrindavan and Gokul And this would be 1994 to 95, something like this. So, spent time, did that, and came back and was basically like, man, fuck that. I'm never doing yoga again. It was just too much. I had to memorize the primary series of Ashtanga before I went to India, which I mostly did. And then I also had to be vegetarian when I was there. I didn't grow up vegetarian. And it was really challenging. I had probably an incredible experience that changed me for the better for the rest of my life. But as a 13-year-old boy coming from where I was, I resisted so much of it, and it caused a bit of distance. And so I didn't do any yoga. I didn't talk to Sharon and David for a number of years after that. I was done with yoga, and then slowly started to get back into it as a teen.
What do you think, why this happened? Was it that you had been too young, too much of the practice, or was it more this fact of coming back to the world where you had been before and the clash of all these, what you experienced?
I mean, it could be the clash. I don't know that I could put my finger on it so specifically, what any one factor determined the resistance to it. I think that there's always this kind of sense of culture shock because where we were in the 90s in India, some of the places were pretty low tech, let's say, very rural. So if you wanted to take a shower, you go to the well, you get the water out of the well, you go to the bathroom, there's no toilet paper, you use your hand, you use cold water from the well. The cups that we would use were often clay. They had these clay cups, so you drink your tea and then the clay cup just kind of decomposes and then they make another one later. And now this is all very like, wow, eco-friendly and green and forward-thinking. But at the time, just every aspect of what we were doing was a challenge. And difficult. And even though there were some things, like if I describe my upbringing to some people, like if I describe the building that I lived in didn't have a door in the front, if I describe the people who lived in my building, if I described, you know, the problems that my parents had, or the neighborhood, the details of the neighborhood and the violence and seeing people, you know, finding dead bodies and things like this. If I describe these things, people will think like I had a very hard upbringing. And I think part of that is true. But it was hard in a different way. And when I was in India, the things that were easy for me, running water, going to the store, being able to just kind of be my own person, which even though my neighborhood wasn't the most safe, like kids still hung out late at night. And I didn't feel comfortable to do any of those things. I didn't understand the language. So I think there was a lot of hard things that were difficult where I wasn't used to them being difficult. That was part of it. The yoga practice being one of them. But I think also maybe just not ready, so ready for it. And then coming back and being able to indulge in all of that. Like, wow, I can go to the store and just get like a cheeseburger again. That's amazing. I can, you're like, this is incredible.
Okay, and then you had that break.
Had that break. Went immediately to hang out with my friends. Hanging out in the street. And then a little bit, like when I was 16, I started spending a little bit of time at Jivamukti. Mm-hmm. Working there. Mm-hmm. Like just once a week or something like this.
And do you remember what brought you back to work there? Was it more that like you had been looking for a job, contact to the uncle, or was it more again, okay, it's pulling me back to the practice?
Definitely wasn't. Or? No. There was no spiritual pull at all. There was no like, oh, you should do this. So really, I was in high school, and once a week, I needed to have a placement of working or volunteering in some mm-hmm. place that was a little bit different than a normal job. Like mm-hmm. I couldn't just work at the Gap or something like this. I had to work at something at a place that was culturally different or volunteer-based so that it helped community-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I thought maybe they'll be okay with a yoga school, my high school, and so they were, and so I started there. And that was originally why I went back. But then when I was there, I started to find many of the things that I had been looking for outside of yoga. A sense of community, a sense of well-being, a sense of purpose. One of the things that yoga has allowed me to do is express a part of myself that really likes putting ideas together.
Mm-hmm.
So like looking at the philosophy of yoga and being open and questioning, which I didn't find so much in school and which I didn't find so much in the street, but I found elements in those places. And so mm-hmm. I was looking for more validation, more care, more sense of community and belonging, sense of self-worth, and the ability to challenge myself through unique experiences. And so I was starting to find that more and more at the yoga school.
Mm-hmm.
At 17, I was arrested for armed robbery. So I had been hanging out with some guys and doing the same things that they did, and we were doing them together. And one day we got caught and arrested for armed robbery. One of the guys mm-hmm. had a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how much experience you have with being arrested in New York City. This was my second arrest by this time. And so what usually happens is, okay, so the police grab you, they take you, and they put you into a police station,
mm-hmm.
right? So you spend some time there, they fingerprint you, they talk to you, and then they send you to a place called Central Booking, which is where all the different police stations send all of the people that they have arrested. Many cells inside this big building, and you move from cell to cell on your way up to see a judge. And so the judge decides at a certain point, and the last cell you're in, and you know, each cell has 30 people, let's say. It's supposed to have 15 to 20, but usually they're overcrowded. It's like around 30 people, depending on if you get arrested on a weekend, jail trivia. Okay, so the cell that you're in right before you go to see the judge is the cell where you see your lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Like kind of like what they have in the shows and the movies. There's the glass and you pick up the phone like this.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have money to hire a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a public defender, it's called, like the city, the state appoints mm-hmm. you one. And he says, looking at the sheet, he says, look, it's possible. It's your first violent offense. They're probably going to give you 1 to 3, which means you'll have to serve between 1 and 3 years
mm-hmm.
in prison. And we're talking and I'm just kind of focusing on the 1 to 3 years. And I go back to this jail cell and I'm sitting there and I'm not a very big person, right? I'm a petite person, but the cell is filled with all shapes and sizes, but mostly people bigger than me. And I'm only 17. And I'm thinking, you know, this is 1 to 3 years, and okay. And I'm, as I'm sitting there, there's a chant that we do at Jiva Mukti that's very similar, based on the prayer of Saint Francis of Assisi. Do you know Saint Francis?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the version that we do in Jiva Mukti is, make me an instrument for thy will, not mine, but thine be done. Free me from anger, jealousy, and greed. Free me from anger, jealousy, and fear. Fill my heart with joy and compassion. And it just kept looping and looping and looping. And even to a certain point, I was like, wow, you better start having tough thoughts. Like, what are you going to do if somebody comes at you? What are you going to do? Like, how are you going to make phone calls? How are you going to get money in here? And but then the chant just kept coming and it kept coming. And in that moment is when I realized that all of the things that I had been searching for outside of yoga, I was finding within the yoga tradition, within Jiva Mukti, within the community of practitioners. All the things that I mentioned before, a sense of challenge, a sense of belonging, of new experience, of acceptance, of learning and growing. And in that moment, I said, look, I give up the need to control this thing moving forward. If it looks like I'm going to be here for a long time, then I'm still going to pursue yoga here.
That was your thought in that moment.
Yeah, in that moment.
Really crazy. Do you have a sense of that? It's really like, I mean, I was trying to imagine what it meant for a 17-year-old boy sitting there, and then having these kind of thought is really, it's more than an adult thought. That is really crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always been having this kind of question of, do you want to do this one or do you want to do that one?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to be in the streets or do you want to be with this yoga thing?
Yeah.
It was never like, oh, maybe one day I want to be an architect. Oh, maybe one day I want to be a fireman. It's like, no, either I want to do this thing where I'm with my friends and we're doing this over here, hanging out. And I'm also, of course, I got arrested, but I enjoyed it. I liked it. I was good at certain aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
It allowed, you know, growing up in that way taught me to be very creative and to use humor as a defense mechanism. So, you know, it cultivated a sharp wit and problem solving. And so all of those things, which I very much appreciate. And so there was never really like, and maybe, of course, you know, there's always other options, but it never really felt like there was more than these two.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that moment, I was like, you know what? If this is the pull in the most extreme circumstance, then whatever happens, I'm just going to commit myself to yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm going to do, inside or outside. And so it was not a bargaining, like, oh, if I just get out of here, I promise I'm going to behave myself and stick to yoga.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't that at all. I just have the memory of sitting on a stainless steel bench with fluorescent lights, you know, those bright white lights above, and saying, this is, you know, I don't need to do this other thing. Everything that I would like to get, I can do it over here. And it's much more rewarding, it's much safer, and it's much more connected to how I feel as a person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's what I did. I got out. I have to say, I still was hanging out. It wasn't like from one day to the next, things changed. Mm-hmm. Still hanging out. Got arrested a few more times because I hadn't been quite learned.
But you got out of the situation. At that moment, you didn't need to stay there.
At that moment, I went and saw the judge. They released me. I had to go back and forth to court. And then I eventually got sentenced to 5 years of probation. Mm-hmm. 5 years of probation is the maximum amount of probation. And then anything more severe punishment is jail, is prison.
Is prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you could do, like, let's say I could have accepted 8 months of prison or 5 years of probation.
Okay.
And what probation means is that once a week I have to go to a city building. I have to be drug tested. I have to show that I'm working. And then every single day I have to go to a program after school to make sure I'm staying out of trouble.
Yeah.
And so I did that for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like this biography is super long. So let me just fast forward real quick. And do you have a question about what I was just saying?
Yeah. My main question is, first, thank you for your honesty, because I think these is the things usually people are not talking about if they experience something like this. Mm-hmm. So there is still kids in this age that are experiencing what you experienced. Mm-hmm. And there is the part of the kid, and there's perhaps the part of the parents. And I was asking myself what you would have wished for in this situation. Yeah. From society, because especially I would say German society doesn't have a good way in contributing or helping those kids. And also what you had been craving for during this moment, like had you been thinking, okay, I would wish for support, somebody who takes me to sport, whatever. What is this thing where we can, like, also if people hear that and they know people in similar situations, where we can have a learning out of that? Or also when I have a son, you have a son, when they grow up. And for me, it's also like this story that you told, like, and what we always forgot is how fast it can go, that that we perhaps take the wrong road at one moment. And how fast then the consequences are.
Yeah. So I don't tell this story so often, but people, there's enough people, I think, who know that at least I started practicing yoga very young. Mm-hmm. And they often ask me, like, what is the best way to get my kid interested in yoga? And my feeling when somebody asks me that question is, the thing that works for you doesn't necessarily work for everybody else. And so I think trying to convince somebody else that they should be doing the thing often causes a resistance in them. And if they just see you being a happy person because of your practice, that's more than any kind of, that's the best type of encouragement. But I think we both know yoga, people who are practicing yoga, and they don't have the thing that I want. They're not happy in a way that I want to be happy. They're not living in a way that I want to live. And so I don't, there are people who work really hard and are fantastic at their job and have a good amount of money, but also they don't have what I want. And so I would be very cautious about taking advice from somebody that I don't want to emulate. So, and I think that's important for me to remember as a parent. I want to just try to be a person that my son would be interested in knowing. And I think that's really cool. To be somebody that my son is interested in knowing, and everything else is extra if he practices yoga or not. As far as what I would have wanted at that point from society, I think it's reflect in that moment, I don't really know, but reflecting back on it, it raises a really big question for me, because a little bit more about why I was interested in doing the interview with you in the first place, because the question that you originally asked in the email was in reference to what role, if any, is, or what connection does being political and yoga have?
Yeah, that will come. You are going too fast. That is the long
No, no, no. I'm not going to answer that question. I'm not going to answer that question exactly now. But when I think about, like, what do I want from society, or what I would have wanted, this is a political question, I think.
Yeah, but from that point of view, when you had been that young, was it also political? Was it not like more...
Well, when I was that young, I don't know that I knew what I wanted.
Ah, okay.
Right? So I could... Yeah. What I wanted more than anything, perhaps at that time, was the ability to explore. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I was going to explore no matter what. Mm-hmm. It just so happened that because of where I was in my life, and physically where I was in the world, exploration had a lot of negative results.
Yeah.
Because the things that I had access to explore with weren't necessarily positive. So I'm very lucky. A lot of the people that I know from that time, some of them are not alive, some of them are in jail, some of them are stuck in a place in their life where they don't seem like super happy people. Mm-hmm. And maybe super happy isn't the right way to say it, but unhappy people. And so in a way, I'm very fortunate because I could have played or explored with so many other things. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very lucky in that moment that I had yoga as this other exploration, regardless of how I resisted it. So what would I have wanted in that time, in that moment? It's hard for me to say from that perspective because I don't really remember anything other than wanting to explore. Mm-hmm. But maybe I will say, when I think about this question that you're asking in other ways, one thing that is missing for somebody who's around this age, let's say between 12 and 15, 12 mm-hmm. and 16, for a boy or a girl or all the other shades in between, is some kind of, some traditions still have it, but for the most part, particularly in the West, it's lost. But like a coming of age, some kind of process where you transition from youthfulness mm-hmm. into something else, mm-hmm. where you are tasked with some kind of, like something that you must do, something you must complete in order to move into a new phase of your life. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a large part of what I was searching for when I was young. Like, what does it mean to be a man? Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be, like, you gotta be tough, you gotta stand up for yourself, you gotta go out there and get that money. Money's not gonna come to you. People have to respect you. And so, like, how to get that? I think I would have appreciated that at that time. Mm-hmm. A certain sense of direction on how to explore that idea within my society. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But again, this is a little bit in retrospect, you know, it's on looking back.
Yeah, but it's interesting because I think it's a possibility to learn from for the situations people are now in. But are you still working with people at that age practicing yoga?
It's been a little while, but so at the moment, no. Mm-hmm. So, but when I eventually did go to my teacher training, mm-hmm. and one of the first places I taught was my old high school. Because the high school that I graduated from was a high school for young people who showed like some kind of, intelligence that wasn't quite suited for this mm-hmm. box-like form of the American education system. So a lot of kids that maybe got in trouble in school, but still seem to be, have promise. So I went and I taught there twice a week to the high school kids there for three semesters, I think. At least two semesters, but maybe three. Then I went back to my probation center where I was, you know, having to check in and eat and do my homework, where I had to do all of that stuff. I went back and taught a 6 week, no, 8 week program where I had the same young people every day. And we made like a little mini documentary about that. It's called Second Chances. And the organization is called Avenues for Justice. And they represent young people who have been, they're in the criminal justice system in some way. Or they live in the neighborhood and their parents are like, look, he or she is getting a little bit towards the edge. I want him to just come to this program. And so, yeah, I went and taught and I taught in a number of places like this.
And going back to the story, was like you said, there was the decision to just hang out, or the decision to do to stuck to yoga, and then you obviously stuck to yoga. Had there been
with a sprinkle of hanging out,
Exactly. But then more and more the yoga kept coming up. It got more, and you became a teacher yourself. You dived in the practice. Was there ever, or are there still moments where you had been questioning things?
Yes.
Which ones?
Yeah.
And how you deal with it?
I'm questioning it right now.
So
let's say,
what are you questioning right now?
I think the thing that I'm questioning right now is that my life as a yoga teacher has changed so as a yoga teacher and as a yoga practitioner has changed, and I'm trying to figure out how to adapt my desires and expectations and practice to the reality as it exists now. So what that means for me is, so just a little bit of backstory. Did the teacher training. Before that, I was working for Jiva Mukti, as like a salaried employee, right? So I was the general manager and running two studios. And, then I did the teacher training and I taught 27 yoga classes in a week straight out of the
27.
Gate. 27, and many of them were free. So the youth development program was free, homeless shelter free. I was doing my apprenticeship, which I have to teach at, which I had to pay to do. Then I was running around the city and teaching yoga classes. But I was not making even just a small fraction of what I was as a salaried employee. Right? No health benefits, no insurance, and making way less money working many more hours. And I found that I was going to teach yoga class. Like if somebody says, hey, Jules, call me on the phone, do you want to sub my class tonight? I would say yes because of the $30 or $40 that I would get paid. And then I would show up to a place, because in Jiva Mukti we have to give a Dharma talk. There's chanting. You want to be creative and inspire people. But it got to a point where I felt terrible getting up in front of people and pretending like I had something to offer. Because at a certain point, I just didn't have anything that I thought was meaningful to offer. And I had grown up within yoga where my teachers, Sharon and David, I spent time with Swami Nirmalananda. I've been to India. I've had a very good fortune to meet people that I thought were tremendous teachers that caused me to question a lot of what I did in my life. And then for me to stand up and be like, Okay, okay, like Yoga Sutra 1 dot, and just uninspired myself, very basic and very forced. And I thought, I don't want to ruin this thing, and I don't want to come and do this for money. If I'm going to do something for money, it should be obviously that I'm doing it for money. Yoga, I want to do because I'm passionate and creative and excited, and I believe that it leads to a liberated state in some way. I don't want to do it for $30 an hour, 30 euros, whatever. So I put my name in a lottery, you know, where they pick names out of a basket, to be an iron worker. Do you know what an iron worker is?
No.
No. Okay, where do you live?
Now in Düsseldorf.
In Düsseldorf. Okay. So maybe in Düsseldorf or another place where there's a lot of construction. So like in Berlin, there's a lot of construction.
Iron worker.
Yes, but they have these steel poles that stick out of the concrete. So this is called a rebar in English. I don't know what it is in German. And in the States, if you work in the Iron Workers Union, only you can touch this. Like nobody else is, like, so you lift it, you carry it, you put it, you tie it, you bend it, you cut it, you break it, you do all this stuff. For reinforcing concrete, for big foundations. So like a school building or Yankee Stadium or, and they chose 10% of the people who applied, and I got chosen. And
Perfect.
I gave up 26 of my 27 yoga classes. And I taught one yoga class a week on Saturdays. And everything else that I did was construction. And it was amazing. Because, you know, with yoga, you gotta go a little early. Set up the room, make sure the altar's there, put on the candles, maybe light some incense. And when I was teaching, you have these, now you can play your music from your phone, but I was playing music from CDs, so I had to burn the playlist that I made from my computer onto the CD. Or at Jivamukti, we had a 5 CD player, so I had to program the thing to play my playlist. So, you know, it ends up being 3 hours. Then you stay and talk to people, and it's 3 hours for, you know, maybe $30.
$30.
That also gets taxed and blah, blah, blah. And so I was so excited. Oh, I get to do construction. This is amazing. Like you, from the minute you show up to the minute you leave, you get paid. There's no, can you stay late and talk to me about my construction problems? I don't know who I am as a construction worker. No, none of that. And
There was a relief.
it was a relief, and it's physical. You do something, you see the result. With
Really
yoga,
good.
you spend all this time studying, and maybe you see the result, maybe you don't. You gotta wait years. And, you know, I did my teacher training when I was 22. I went into debt. You know, by the time I was a construction worker, I owed like something like $30,000 in credit cards. So I was like, oh. And so I gave that up, started working construction. And there was a Japanese lady who did karma yoga at Jivamukti. She didn't speak hardly any English. She cleaned the floors and cleaned the mats. A friend of hers, who was a friend of mine, and she said, Hale, I think was the lady's name. She says, Hale's birthday is coming. Would you mind giving her an in-class private? An in-class private is where the person takes the class and you give them an assist throughout the whole class. You're just assisting. And that's why I started working construction, so I could do all these other things and not have to worry about it, right? So I said, yeah, sure. I'll give her a free in-class private. My pleasure. I gave her a private. She really, 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 really enjoyed it. She, you know, Japanese culture, people don't touch so much. Particularly in her generation. She was like maybe 15 years older than me. Turns out she was an investment banker who just decided to do karma yoga in New York City. She owned an apartment in New York City.
Okay.
She said, look, I want you to come to Japan. I will pay for everything. I'll pay for your flight. I'll bring you there. And I want you to teach at all these different yoga studios throughout Japan for 2 weeks. So she brought me and introduced me to 6 or 7 different yoga studios. She got articles written for me in different yoga magazines and vegetarian magazines, because I was vegan at the time. And then she invited me again. And from those 2 trips, I met a group of people who then invited me to Hong Kong and Taiwan and South Korea. And I gave up construction, the job that I pursued for money, the job that I gave up because I was losing my love for it. I got again, it was given back to me by somebody because I gave it to them for free. She gave me my career, essentially, in a way of speaking, because I had freed myself up to be in that space.
Mm-hmm.
And so then she, and from that moment, this is 2006 maybe, I spent 9 to 10 months of the year traveling and teaching yoga around the world. And I did that for 10 years. No, more.
And did you enjoy?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I never really traveled, with the exception of one time to India when I was 13. By the time I was in my 20s, like, I'd never really taken a vacation. Mm-hmm. I'd never gone anywhere, never really left New York City. And then here I was flying to Japan to teach for 2 months, all up and down the country or Korea. It was incredible. I met amazing people, and it helped me to grow as a practitioner and as a teacher. And I did that until COVID. And so I've been, there are a few moments. You asked me, have I thought about giving up yoga? Or, like, not giving up yoga, but have I questioned?
Questionizing.
Questioned what it means maybe to be a yoga teacher or a yoga
student. Staying on the path, all these things.
Yeah, or what a path even means.
Yeah.
Like, what does it mean? Yeah. What does a path even mean?
Yeah.
And it's always... The moment that I feel that resistance, because of these moments, like having the chant, not my will, but thy will be done, when I'm in the cell.
Yeah.
Recognizing, wow, I'm saying yes to this class, not because I believe that my class will impact somebody's life, but because I need the money. And now this transition, again, kind of like towards this digital move, or... forcing myself to kind of do things in a digital way that I don't feel so aligned with. More often than not, my yoga practice has been about finding where I'm holding on from a space of fear, and because things have always been that way. And then having the honesty, like in a meditation practice, to sit down and be like, oh, fear is there.
Mm-hmm.
Where's that coming from? Oh, it's this. Okay. So what am I doing that's causing that? And how can I, as you said in the beginning, connect to that space to act in a way that is more... even if it's not immediately beneficial, that it's more fruitful to who I am as a person, as a yoga practitioner, even if it causes short-term loss, even if it makes things uncomfortable now. I'm trying to be a little bit cautious of using the word authenticity.
Yeah.
Right? Like, sometimes it's like, oh, and it's not aligned with my authenticity, and... So I feel like that gets thrown around
sometimes. Unfortunately, it became a little bit of bullshit bingo word.
Yeah. And some, like, is becoming a construction worker aligned with my authenticity, like who I am? No, but it's aligned with what I know that I need in that moment.
Yep.
And I'm willing to put everything else to the side because what I think of as myself and what my needs are don't always align. And so how do I bring those two together?
Mm-hmm.
And then what I find is this path that I think that I'm on is more like wandering through the woods. It's not a path through the woods. It's mm-hmm. wandering through the woods. You know, Germans say that they're going wandern, right?
Like, yeah.
yeah. And usually that means like you went for a hike
mm-hmm.
from point A to point B.
B.
But mm-hmm. what I mean is there's no real path.
There's no goal. You're just...
Yeah. And maybe you end up at a beautiful, beside a beautiful lake. And then you end up by a thing that you have to climb and it's really hard. But you would never say like, oh, I lost my path, because the whole thing is just a walk in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's Krishnamurti. He says freedom is a pathless land or something like this. J. Krishnamurti. Jiddu. So? And that's, now we're here. Now I'm questioning what it means to be a parent, be a yoga practitioner and teacher.
Yeah.
In a country that I'm not originally from, while trying to learn a language and figure out where is the space for my own practice. I mean, there's a lot to juggle, and I think a lot of people can relate to that.
Definitely. And at the moment, you are taking it like wandering around, and you are like, sitting with it and seeing where it takes you, because there had been always these moments in life where it took you in a certain direction?
Yeah, it took me in a certain direction, but I had to make a decision.
Yeah.
And so I haven't made that decision mm-hmm. at this
okay. yeah.
juncture.
Mm-hmm.
But I can feel it coming, and I think my resistance to making the decision has been insecurity, because I think the change will be more different than it has been in the past.
Mm-hmm.
That things will look, things will look different. And settling with, pulling the trigger, as they say, mm-hmm. getting on the mat, sitting on the cushion, I just have to do it.
Yeah. Are you good with changes? Do you like changes? Because you said you like to explore as a yeah. kid, and it's exploration. How is it with changes? Would you say you're embracing yeah. when there's change mm. or there's more?
Yeah, I think the change that has happened now is that there's a certain level of freedom that I have come to appreciate that is no longer there. Like there's a certain level of freedom of being able to get up and go that I just don't have as a parent as it exists now. I can't go to Japan and travel for 2 months with mm-hmm. a 2-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
yeah. And teach yoga and sleep in a tiny hotel or at a friend's place on mm-hmm. a couch or like, mm-hmm. It's not like somebody can say, oh, look, we want to do this thing tomorrow. Do you want to come? No. And that's one aspect that I miss.
Mm-hmm.
So learning how to, that sense of exploration, how do I keep that and say, okay, instead of travel and spontaneity, how do I translate that into parenthood?
Yeah.
How do I translate that into teaching? In a different form.
Yeah.
Or practice in a different form. Like, can I get excited about spontaneously practicing?
Mm-hmm.
So Martina, who you have interviewed, my lovely wife, she really likes to practice like on a schedule, right? Like we practice this every day at this time, and we wake and we do this. And she really likes that rigidity. Or maybe rigidity is not the word, but she really likes that continuity.
Yeah.
That regularity.
Yeah.
And I don't like that so much. Mm-hmm. But she's lost that regularity because with Rio, it's a little bit unpredictable. Is he going to Kita today? Is he not going to Kita today? Yeah. Right? Am I going to be able to practice today from 9 to 11? Or will I not be able to practice from 9 to 11?
Yeah.
So can I get excited? Oh, he's here in the morning, but when he goes to sleep, I'm going to be excited about the spontaneity of being able to practice from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m.
And what would the yoga philosophy tell us about that? That's what I'm asking myself a lot. Because as you say, these things of, there's also a question here. No? How does it change to be a teacher? How does the yoga practice change when you became a parent? And you said it, all of these struggles, these thoughts, how to do it, how to change things. And then there is these challenges. The kid doesn't want to go. The kid is screaming. The kid is, there's a lot of things every day. They are new. It interrupts the own practice that is perhaps always at a safe spot. Practice cannot be done. So there's a lot of things where we need to adapt, accept, and then at the same time reflect and understand and still be there and holding space. And I'm always asking myself, is there one part in the philosophy, in the texts that gives, I'm always searching for advice, but like an advice or that tells us how to deal with those situations?
Yeah. I think one of the verses that I always enjoy from the Yoga Sutra.
Yeah.
Let me just make sure that I'm getting the number right.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's number 39. Yata bhimata dhyanat va. So Yoga Sutra, first chapter, the Samadhi Pada. Yoga Sutra, Patanjali says, now I'm going to Atta Yoga Nushasanam. Now I'm going to talk about yoga. Atta Yoga Nushasanam, Yogas Chitta Vritti Nirodha. Yoga is when one no longer identifies with the movements of the mind. Atta Yoga Nushasanam. Drastu svarupe vastanam. Then one sits or experiences them as their true self, their svarup, the seer, experiences themselves as the svarup. Svarupe vastanam. Vritti svarupyam itaratra. Or one becomes identical with the movements of the mind. So Patanjali lays out two things first. There's the state of yoga. You're no longer identifying with the fluctuations of the mind, the movement of the mind, the emotions, the thoughts, they come, they go. There's some svarup, there's some essential nature, according to Patanjali's philosophy. Or this essential nature and the thoughts, feelings, emotions, everything that's moving on, they seem like they're one thing. You are mad. I am mad. As opposed to, oh, there is anger there. But there's something underneath that is my essential nature. So this is kind of how he lays it out. And then he says, okay, if you're stuck in the thoughts, in the mind, here are different things that you can do. Verse number 12 talks about practice and detachment. Okay, what are you going to do if you're stuck in the mind? You can do practice. Doesn't define what practice is exactly, like what kind of practice. He says, practice, do it over and over, and that will lead to and should be combined with detachment, vairagya. Okay. Then he gives all of these different forms of detachment, two forms of detachment, then different forms of practice. And then I want to say, verse number 29 of the first chapter, He lists 9 obstacles to the practice. And these 9 obstacles are something that every practitioner and every, for sure, yoga practitioner who is a parent has experienced. So let me just, I have a Yoga Sutra up. Let me just see. I can... Okay, so it's number 30. So the obstacles, this is from Sri Brahmananda, the obstacles which distract the mind are physical and mental troubles. Has anybody ever experienced that? Confusion about what to do, that's what we're talking about right now. Doubt or skepticism, if you have no doubt or skepticism in your yoga practice, you probably haven't been practicing for very long. Carelessness, moments of inactivity or inattention, lack of interest, lethargy or laziness. I wonder if there are any parents, yoga practitioners, who ever felt lazy. Your kid goes to Kita and you just want to take a break. Awakening of worldly mindedness. Sometimes this one is translated as sexual preoccupation. Mm-hmm. So again, it just goes on like this.
Yeah.
Patanjali lists all of the obstacles at this stage of practice. Yeah. And then he says, okay, you want to overcome these obstacles? You can focus on the repetition of Om. You can focus on pranayama, the in and the out breath. You can focus on an internal object of meditation. He goes like this and he lists them until he gets to number 39, and he just, Patanjali says, or just pick whatever you want. That's, he's, just do something.
Yeah.
Also, meditate on anything that pleases you and brings calmness to the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Consistency in practice is the hardest thing. So how to get excited or interested or consistent with the practice?
Yeah.
With the things that bring calmness, the things that bring a sense of being centered.
Mm-hmm.
Consistently. That is the trick. How to do that when you're feeling lazy. How to do that when you're... One thing that is important, friends, satsang.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to podcasts, going to yoga class. I mean, going to yoga class for me is so much easier to practice than when I'm at home.
Yeah, definitely.
Satsang, having somebody you can practice with. Mm-hmm. Having somebody you can look at. You know, I listened to this podcast. He talked about the first book of the Yoga Sutra. You want to read it with me?
Mm-hmm.
So much nicer.
And the consistency, would you say it's the most important, really, because you highlighted it, is it the most important part? And does consistency means every day? That's what people also ask really often, because there had been this examples around of practice every day, and then people think practice every day means being 1 hour on this yoga mat doing a really challenging vinyasa class, which it doesn't need to be when we talk about practice. But does consistency means for you to sit down every day and do one part that means yoga?
I think you should have some level of commitment.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are going to practice, if your goal, let's say, is to practice consistently every day for 5 minutes, yeah, then you want it to be clear. Where were those 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Now, if your commitment is, I'm a very physical person,
mm-hmm,
and asana really helps me to be calm, mm-hmm, to be peaceful, to be centered, and I want to practice consistently. Well, if you practice 3 days a week for a month, that's consistent.
Mm-hmm.
If you practice 3 days a week for a year, that's consistent.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, you've said you're going to do 3 days a week. Because the practice doesn't really bear fruit unless it meets with resistance. So you can't say, I'm going to practice every day, and then just look back on your day and say, you know, my practice today was somebody got angry with me and I was peaceful with them. When you had told yourself, my practice is going to be 45 minutes asana every day. No. Now you're suiting the thing to fit your inability to manage time. So, no, you say, okay, I'm going to practice every day 45 minutes. And then it's 8 p.m. and you're really tired. And you're, oh, but I still have to do my 45 minutes.
And it's so good afterwards. There's such a good feeling afterwards. It doesn't matter with what it is, huh, that we do to commit to say to commit to. If we did it then it's like...
But then you learn the power of your words. Mm-hmm. And you learn the power of commitment and keeping commitment and to take it very seriously. So you don't say something like, I'm going to practice every hour, an hour every day, because you know that's not possible. You know that's too much for you.
Yeah.
So you know what? I'm going to practice at least Monday, Wednesday, Friday for an hour.
Mm-hmm. Ah, commitment, such a complicated topic.
Yeah.
But what I want to know also from you is the political part, even though it's a quite hard switch, but I don't want to take too much of your time also. Yeah. And you said also that was something that you got caught by in the email. It's something that we asked Martina about also, because I saw that she was sharing a lot. There is a lot of things going on, and the question basically was if the yoga teacher, or if yoga is political, and if the yoga teachers should implement their political, let's not say opinion or advice, but impression and about what's going on in the class, or if the yoga is a space where we say, which I think sometimes, I'm really 50-50 about that, because I'm thinking sometimes, okay, there I go to a yoga class, that is the space where I don't want to hear sometimes about what's going on out there, about all of this shit. Mm-hmm. I'm then looking for the stuff you told at the beginning. I'm looking for the peaceful moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, first as a general statement, I don't believe that there's any one way that a yoga teacher needs to express this.
Yeah, okay.
So do all yoga teachers need to be political? No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
But that means the opposite as well. Not all yoga is apolitical.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes people will tell me, oh, yoga and politics don't match. That is the same level of extreme statement as saying all politics and yoga go together. So I don't know that there's any one. However, it seems to me that living an examined life, which is what a yoga practitioner is trying to do, lead an examined life. Why am I doing what I'm doing? How do my actions impact the world around me?
Mm-hmm.
How does the world around me impact me? It seems a natural and logical progression to be concerned about a greater and greater portion of the world. And to be concerned about the world and to act in a way that you think is in the best interest of the mm-hmm. well-being of those around you is a very political stance. Now, people might disagree on how best to do that. Some people might say the best way you can help the world is by refining yourself. I'm going to meditate for world peace. The trouble that I find is that if somebody truly believes that something they see out in the world is wrong, maybe it did and I'm unaware of it, it's totally possible, but most meaningful and lasting changes that we've experienced have come from people taking direct action.
Mm-hmm.
Women didn't get the right to vote through meditation. They got the right to vote through marching in the streets and demanding it.
Mm-hmm.
People of color in the United States didn't get better opportunities because they meditated or because they did funny things with their body. They had to march and put their bodies on the line in harm's way in order to get those things. I think it's also important to recognize that at the seat of every resistance, there is a spiritual element. So Martin Luther King was a pastor.
Say that again.
At the heart or at the root or at the base of many of these movements is a spiritual foundation, a spiritual belief.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at a lot of environmentalists, especially within the United States, environmental movements often align themselves with traditional Native American wisdom teachings of being in union with the earth, mm-hmm, and honoring the earth as the foundation for them to get the strength to then go out and handcuff themselves to a pipeline or to block a, mm-hmm, bulldozer. The resistance movement, the Satyagraha that Gandhi started, was based in Hinduism and the Bhagavad Gita. Martin Luther King was based on a certain form of, the black churches of the South. All of these movements had at their core some kind of spiritual or religious foundation where they could come together and for peace, for good community, for strength, so that they could go out and do the work. So every strong political movement had at its core, maybe not every, but most that we know of, had a strong religious or spiritual foundation.
Mm-hmm.
The ones we agree with and the ones we don't agree with. The ones that we think of as extreme, fanatics, and the ones that we think of as more moderate.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all of them have some kind of binding spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And what better place to be political than to know that you have people with you who share the same core values of compassion,
mm-hmm,
so you can trust those people really do want the best,
mm-hmm,
in their political endeavors, and they're not just seeking power, recognition, or fame.
Mm-hmm. So community. More community thoughts.
Community and part of a collective narrative that's larger than ourselves. Mm-hmm. So if you go into a Baptist church, you believe in God. You believe in that God is with you and on your side. And as Martin Luther King said, the arc of justice, right? That Gandhi was talking about, that when we harm others, we harm ourselves because we are part of this larger thing. To be part of a larger thing is incredibly important for longevity, mm-hmm, in a political sphere where people are trying their best to silence your voice.
Mm-hmm. I'm all the time thinking about this active Buddhism that also went in that direction, right? That they transform from to add this active part to meditation. So there's a certain term for it.
The Dalai Lama is a political exile.
Yeah.
He's a world teacher, a Buddhist teacher, but he is a political exile who speaks up on the sovereignty for Tibet.
That's a good example. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think people that don't want yoga to be political are not always, but often dealing with the conflict between earning a living and making people uncomfortable who pay them for their classes.
There comes this challenge again, also where you had been inside this thing of, okay, I'm earning my money with this, I'm paying my rent, and therefore I cannot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then who wants to go to the yoga class where the person is like, and then 10,000 children were killed. Inhale one, exhale, like, no.
Depends. I mean, it always depends. Sometimes you go out and you think, okay, somebody woke me up. That's really good. And there's also other things. My own suffering is not that bad as I thought. There's other things I need to open up. I think it always depends. That's what I, Yeah.
But I think as I said before,
yeah,
people are often coming in the beginning to chase or find or recreate a positive emotion. And
not only in the beginning, or especially if we are in
middle,
if we are in challenging times, I guess, then we try to seek these relaxation, these positive things.
Totally. But I think you can still get that with the political engagement.
Yeah.
When you allow yourself to be first uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like a really good, you know, a sermon in a church. It needs to be done by somebody who knows what they're doing. To talk about the darkness, but still give hope and empowerment. Not talk about the things that are wrong with the world and then just say downward facing dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. The last three questions. What do we need more?
Who's we?
In this world. People. Humans. Society.
I think humans do really good with wanting more. I think it might be really nice if the way I hear that question, I would translate it or rearrange it to say we could do with a lot less. We could do with a lot less stuff. If our needs were reduced, if our wants were reduced, I think that would go a long way.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say we have too much of?
Almost everything.
Computers. Yeah, almost everything. News, handies.
Everything. Every single.
Everything is
pretty
too much.
Pretty much every single thing. And I mean it from the big to the small. At the risk of sounding a little bit silly, most people have too many spoons in their house.
Yeah.
Like, who needs, nobody uses all those spoons.
You don't need all
of this stuff.
Yeah.
Requires energy and effort.
Stuff. Mm-hmm.
It's just so much. And what do we have too much of? Everything. Why do I say that? Because it causes complacency and too much comfort. Because we have so much stuff, we have so much comfort. When we have so much comfort, we have to make artificial discomfort.
That's interesting.
An asana practice is an artificial discomfort. An exercise is an artificial discomfort. Do you think somebody who works with their body on a farm wants to go take a spinning class? Or a high-intensity interval training? No, because they use their body. They're there. If we go to somebody who gathers their food, do they want to then do a 90-minute asana practice? No. An asana practice is for somebody who doesn't move, sits at a desk. I mean, we even have classes for carpal tunnel. Reduce your knee stress, reduce your knee strain. These are bandages for a society that is very comfortable and complacent. And when I mean comfortable, I mean not needing to work with their bodies to get the things that they need. Mm-hmm. Not needing to troubleshoot, most of us, particularly in the West.
Mm-hmm. So less comfort.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A little less comfort, a little less ease, a little more effort in other direction.
Is there a book that you read the last month that you would recommend? Or is there a text that you would like to recommend? Something, I want to know something that, not something that you think fits to the people, I want to know something that inspired you the last time you read it or hear it or...
Well, I'll give you two things. So right now I'm reading I have to look up the title again. It's a book by Joan Halifax, who's a Zen Buddhist teacher. Mm-hmm. It's called Being with Dying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm reading that at the moment. And so I'll let you know how that goes. Although I enjoy her work and I mm-hmm. enjoy, I think, reading a book about dying, confronting one's own mortality, is the process of less comfort and less complacency. To be with death, so often part of our comfort is that death happens away from us. Old people are away from us. Dying is away from us. It's very sterile until it happens, and then it's a whole new world. And then I really enjoy science fiction. And I believe that there are a lot of truths that can be told through story. And when I was younger, I read Dune. And before the movie came out, I reread it. And there's 6 books in the series. And so I read all 6 of them recently. And I really enjoyed that.
Nice.
Yeah. So there's those 2 for the price of 1.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For your Thank time you. And for the answers. And I hope you could also enjoy a little bit. And it was not just challenging or exhausting to answer.
That was great.
Ihr Lieben, vielen Dank fürs Dabeisein, vielen Dank fürs Zuhören, vielen Dank an Jules Verbray für diese 1,5 Stunden. Ich weiß, es ist eine lange Folge geworden, aber da sitzt natürlich auch ein Mann, der viel zu erzählen hat, der viel aus der Geschichte, aus seinem eigenen Leben erzählen kann, und da brauchen wir manchmal ein bisschen länger, das geht dann nicht immer so schnell. Jules Verbray macht gemeinsam mit seiner Frau Martina, die ihr vielleicht aus dem Podcast und dem Magazin auch kennt, das Liberation Lab. Wir packen euch den Link in die Shownotes, und alles Weitere zu ihm findet ihr auf seiner Website www.julesverbray.com. Dort findet ihr auch, wann er unterrichtet, wo ihr mit ihm praktizieren könnt. Und meine Empfehlung, auf jeden Fall mal eine Klasse mit ihm besuchen oder das Liberation Lab für euch ganz bequem von zu Hause aus ausprobieren. Wir freuen uns, wenn ihr beim nächsten Mal wieder mit dabei seid. Alles Liebe und bis bald, eure Simone. Lasst uns gerne Feedback zu dieser Folge da.